Hey, good morning, Hope. Good to see you all on this homecoming weekend. Too soon? That was a tough game. That was a very tough game. And a Viking Sunday. Football is just hurting us left and right, taking our parking, letting us down. Safe place. We can lament things like that here together. So good to see you. My name is Davis. If I hadn't had the chance to meet you yet, I'm one of the pastors here at our downtown location. When I was growing up, I watched a lot of daytime television. Any daytime television fans in the room having it on in the background? You know, like the game shows, you got Price is Right and Jeopardy and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire when that was going. Or the talk shows. We had a lot of talk shows growing up in my household. Regis and Kelly, Live with Regis and Kelly. He's been replaced a few times. Live with Kelly. Who is it now? Kelly and someone? Someone? Okay. Oprah. Oprah was a fan favorite in the household, always on in the background. I bring this up because there was a line in one of these shows, and for the life of me, I could not remember it. I think it was Oprah, that my mom and I would talk about for years, and to this day, we still talk about it. We heard it on there, and I quoted one of them. I'm not sure if it was Regis and Kelly or Oprah, but the line is this. It says, when someone shows you who they really are, believe them. That was the line that we heard in one of these talk shows. When someone shows you who they really are, believe them. And over the years, my mom and I would talk about this, and especially as I became a Christian and thought more about what this line means, and specifically the parenthetical following this line. In other words, the assumption of what this line means. If somebody shows you their true colors, treat them as such, is what this line is saying. And I bring this up because our passage in Hosea this morning is going to challenge this idea very strongly. This idea that when someone shows you who they really are, you should treat them as such, is almost the exact opposite of how God has been treating his people through this book of Hosea. If you're just joining us for the first time this Sunday, we're in a series in the Old Testament book of Hosea. It's way back, somewhere in the middle of the Old Testament, a very small book, and it's ultimately a book about Jesus and how he treats his people, and how he's constantly going to move towards them regardless of the faults and the flaws that he sees in them. But he uses a lot of big language. This prophet, Hosea, uses a lot of big language to get there. And today, we are interrupting a litany of bad news that we've been seeing in this book so far with a giant breath of fresh air of good news. And I'm excited to sit in it with you this morning. We're going to be in Hosea 2, verses 14 to 20, if you did bring a Bible and would like to follow along. Otherwise, I'll have the words on the screen. This is Hosea 2. It says this, therefore, this is God talking, I am now going to allure her. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back her vineyards and will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There, she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. I will remove the names of the Baals from their lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day, I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, and the creatures that move along the ground, bow and sword, and battle. I will abolish from the land so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. That is our passage this morning. And like I said, just a lot of good news. This is where I want us to go, though. Just three brief sections, if you are the outline inclined and want to know where we're going. This is our roadmap for today. I first just want to make an observation about this therefore and all that it can teach us about the divine logic of grace, because it is surprising, and it's easy to glaze over a small word like therefore. And then I want to camp out on one section in this passage. There are many that we could do, but I just want to do one, and specifically this valley of trouble. Talk more about that in a second. And then lastly, just so what? Where do we go from here? How do we take this into the rest of our Sunday even, on a Vikings parking lot filled Sunday, and the rest of the week? What does Hosea 2 have for us? Before we do that though, I think we do need to park and back up the bus a little bit. Because again, if you are just joining us or if you've already forgotten where we've been in Hosea, there's been a lot to cover, a lot to fill our minds with first before we hear this good news. Hosea specifically is this prophet. And if you remember back to week one, Pastor Kaur outlined a lot of the themes that we'd be seeing or a lot of the rhetorical tools that a prophet like Hosea uses to communicate these ideas. Specifically, he's going to reach back on history, a lot of the history of God and his people, and then he's going to draw symbols or symbolism out through these stories. But one of the most specific things about prophets, and Hosea in particular, is that they use what's called a speech act. They communicate, they speak through their actions, or God calls a prophet to do something very significant to draw attention to, this is the thing I want you to pay attention to. And in Hosea, the big speech act has been Hosea being called, this prophet, to go and marry a woman who has had many lovers, to go and marry a prostitute. And this is going to communicate something super loud, ultimately not about the relationship between Hosea and Gomer, his wife, but ultimately about God and his people. Hear the words of Catherine Kroger, a scholar of Hosea. She says this, Israel takes the place of Gomer as the unfaithful wife. That's ultimately what's happening here in this book. Yahweh brings a case against his people. The images of Israel alternate among those of unfaithful wife, mother, children of the land, while Yahweh appears in the role of plaintiff, prosecutor, judge, and enforcer of punishment. Yahweh being this Old Testament name for God. She goes on, most of Hosea 2 clearly speaks to Israel rather than to Hosea's wife. That's what we've been seeing over these last few weeks. That God is making declarations, he's making statements, ultimately condemning a lot of his people and their actions towards him. Israel will be allowed to discover the consequences of its behavior. It would learn that the good gifts came from Yahweh rather than Baal, the false god they were worshiping. Defeat and exile will be a part of the punishment. No allies will come to its aid. The huge overarching idea so far in Hosea has been a lot of bad news, specifically looking at how idolatry, a worship of a false god like Baal, is intimately connected, even the opposite side of the same coin of adultery. These things go hand in hand according to Hosea and all that we've been seeing. You can't commit one without committing the other spiritually towards God. The moment you turn from God and worship another god, God is saying, do you see what's happening here? It's as if you're committing adultery against me. The intimacy that I designed you to have with me is ultimately what idolatry is. And we've been hearing this in wave after wave as God has been pulling back the curtain of heaven and showing us this, from my perspective, is what it looks like to turn from me. And similarly, you cannot commit adultery, even physically in this life, without first committing idolatry, without first rejecting the God who made you and gets to have a final say on who you are. And so last week, Pastor Kaur camped out or led us through the first chapter or the first part of chapter 2. And this is the last verse. And it just hits like a brick when God says, I'm gonna punish Israel for the day she burned incense to the false gods. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and she went after her lovers. And they hear these four words, but me, she forgot, declares the Lord. But me, she forgot. That's God's four words of what idolatry is. And who hasn't done this? Who has not looked at their life and thought, you know what? I think I've got this. I think I'm gonna be God of my life. I think I'm gonna decide what is good for me and ultimately the arc and direction of where I wanna go. And even though God made me, I think I know what's ultimately best for me. And so this is where our passage picks up this morning. And it picks up with this word, therefore. And I know many of you grew up in the church, and so if I set a line like, if you see a word therefore in a passage, you have to ask, what's it? Look at that, well done, come on. If you're like, what the heck just happened? The line is, if you see the word therefore in the passage, you have to ask what it's there for. It's a play on words to ultimately say, You can figure out the logic of a passage. Whenever you see this word therefore, it's connecting an idea, kind of an if-then statement. Like if a parent's speaking to a child after they flagrantly disobeyed them, they're gonna say, you disobeyed me, therefore you are grounded, right? The therefore is just the thing that connects ideas and takes it to the next, to its logical conclusion. And so everywhere we've been so far in Hosea 2, the therefore would be what? Desolation, judgment, exile, even death. Adultery in the Old Testament, according to the Old Testament law, is punishable ultimately by death. Any form of sin since Genesis 3 is something that is worthy and deserving of death. But here in this passage, following the word therefore, we are blindsided by good news, and it makes no logical sense. This word, grace, is a very common Christian word that we might have heard growing up, and we might have several ideas of what it can mean. And in fact, I think if we pulled 10 of us in this room, we might have 8 or 9 different answers of what this word means. But the big idea I have for us this morning behind this word therefore is to be confronted and surprised by the fact that God is showing up with a logic that supersedes ours. And often what he's bringing to the table, especially behind this word grace, doesn't always add up. So I want to borrow from a friend. His name is Steve Brown. And if you want to dig into the idea of grace, he runs a ministry called Key Life Ministries. And the whole tagline, right when you go to the website, the first thing that pops up, you know how like websites nowadays, they just get right in your face with something before you can look at the thing you want to see. They're like, hey, here's the thing I have for you. And Key Life, they still have that thing, but it just says, God's not mad at you. God's not mad at you. In summary, Steve Brown's definition of grace is God is not mad at you. Here I'm elaborate on what that means. Generally, the English word for grace has to do with beauty, winsomeness, attractiveness, or charm. As is often the case though, God in the Bible takes a common word and then he sanctifies it, or he gives it new and more profound meaning. The word grace has very little to do with what is commonly understood by our English word. In fact, Scripture says that grace isn't a personal virtue at all, but rather it's undeserved favor lavished on an inferior by a superior. It goes on. Pete Atwinson has a great definition of grace. Grace is doing good for someone when there is no compelling reason to do so. And every reason, in fact, not to. That's it. That is the grace God has given us. That's the grace of Hosea 2. The therefore that we expect is interrupted by something that is wholly undeserved. It's called amazing grace. Because when you understand it, when you experience it, when you see it as it truly is, and don't just breeze past the therefore, it takes your breath away. Many of us are familiar with the verse in Isaiah 55 where God says through the prophet Isaiah, my ways are higher than your ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways. And my thoughts are higher than your thoughts. There are so many categories that this is true of God to us. But one of the ways I think we often overlook is how his grace is higher than our understanding of grace. Typically, our understanding of grace is some form of being nice to people, regardless of what they do. But God's grace is something that interrupts us, this unmerited favor in the midst of deserved judgment. God comes in and he offers a kindness. Therefore, God is going to draw Israel out and he's going to heal her. He's going to speak tenderly to her and he's going to restore that which has been taken away by their own sin and rejection of God. That's what we're seeing so far in Hosea 2. And grace itself, like Steve Brown's definition here of unmerited favor, something that God just lavishes on you regardless of your merit, is something that whenever we see glimpses of it, and I think we see lots of glimpses in everyday life, it takes our breath away, as Steve was saying. It draws us in with a type of unfailing kindness, something that's beyond us, that makes us wonder, makes us see that maybe this really is the heart of reality. And it's one of the reasons that I think this show is so popular right now. I hear some rumblings of chuckle, meaning I know some of you have been watching the show Ted Lasso. I know a lot of our culture has been watching Ted Lasso because this show blew up the Emmys and earned like 11 awards that were all well-deserved. Plenty of aspects about this show that are less admirable, but the overarching arc of what this show is doing is so compelling when seen through the lens of grace. If you've never even heard of the show or don't even know what it's about, it essentially, Ted Lasso, Jason Sudeikis, it's actually built on a commercial from like 6 years ago. Crazy. Ted Lasso is this D2 football coach in the States, and he gets pulled overseas to the UK to coach a football team, a soccer team. It's not football. Football's here. We don't have any right to say anything about football in Minnesota. But anyway, soccer is what he's going to coach. And he knows nothing about this sport. And in many ways, actually, the people who recruit him over there are doing this to spite him and to kind of make a fool out of him so that he will ultimately fail. But every single person that Ted Lasso interacts with, he's already decided in his mind that he cares about them. He's already decided in his mind, this is how I'm going to treat you. Regardless of what you show me, going back to that Oprah line or Regis and Kelly line, I'm going to treat you like this. And no matter what I see in you, I've decided this is how I'm going to treat you. This is why, if you're anything like me, you start crying out of nowhere when you're watching this show. It's so compelling and so beautiful, and it's just this tiny glimpse of grace. That when somebody deserves punishment, that when somebody deserves mistreatment, especially when we see it in a television series, when we see it lived out in a compelling fashion, it knocks us backwards. Ted Lasso is a picture of that grace, and I think that's why all of us are blindsided by this show. First Peter, when he's talking about prophets and grace, says this, concerning this salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was to come to you, they searched intently. He's talking about Hosea. When Hosea is getting these ideas from God, he's searching intently, trying to figure out, what are we talking about? They're searching with the greatest care, trying to find out the time and the circumstances to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing ultimately to the sufferings of the Messiah and the glories that would follow. Even angels long to look into these things. This is an invitation in the New Testament for all of us who hear the words of a prophet like Hosea to look for grace, to look for the gospel, to look ultimately for what God is communicating through these big, extravagant words sometimes. Sometimes the prophets speak in terms that they don't even quite understand. And we have a lot of that happening here in Hosea. And I bring this up because it reminded me of a good way to read the prophets. Anybody know what kind of rock this is? Agate, yes. Agates are all scattered throughout the North Shore. I think it's some type of volcanic rock that growing up, my oldest brother was a wizard at finding these things. I don't think I ever found a single one, but he would find them all the time. Whenever we'd go visit, we'd just sit on the shore, and to find an agate, you just have to keep scanning. Same like 5x5 section of rocks. You just keep looking through them all. And then you go and revisit and you look through them again. And he would just find them one after the other. And I think that methodology is helpful as we're reading the prophets. It's just to keep reading it, keep looking for what's discoverable in these words, as 1 Peter was just describing. That grace is found in these words and that the message, the agate, the beauty is ultimately discoverable by continuing to turn back to it. I bring this up because we have about 6 or 7 more weeks left of Hosea. And in 6 or 7 weeks, I want to call all of us to remember that we are never done with this book. There are more agates to be found. Turn back to even, we're going to look at like one thing today in this section, but there are so many. In fact, this is a way that we often talk about just understanding the big story of the Bible, right? Creation, fall, redemption, restoration. If you've been around Hope a long time, you've heard this probably several times from up front. If you're new to Hope, this is a tool meant to help us understand the big story of God and see that the Old and the New Testament work together as one to communicate the same story that you can ultimately break down to these four chapters. Creation, when God created everything. Fall, when mankind turned back from God and said, just like we've seen in this passage, I'm going to be my own God. And then most of the story of the Bible is this third category, redemption. Now, we spend a lot of time on creation and fall whenever we put this in front of ourselves as a church. And that's because so much of the Bible is about redemption. Even here in Hosea 2, I counted at least 15 broad strokes or themes or concept or agates, if you will, of redemption that deserve our time and our attention and our revisiting and our finding grace and the gospel in these stories. So much good news found here in Hosea 2. But anytime Emma, my wife, asks me to do like things around the house, she's a list maker, especially right now. She's nesting. She's third trimester of pregnancy. And so she's into to making lists. And she's nodding as she walks in. Yep. Talking about you. whenever she makes me a list, she gives me like 3 to 10 things. And she has to put it on the fridge or to write it on a whiteboard, because if she just tells me them, she knows she only gets one. She only gets one thing if she just tells me them. And similarly, I just want us to look at the one thing from this list of 15 today. And that's this door of hope, number 4. You can tell we're doing number 4 because I italicized it. That's how you know. We're going through the door of hope. Specifically in Hosea 2, 14 to 20, or verse 15, God says, there is where I'm going to make the valley of Achor a door of hope. Now, if you're like me, you read this passage or this description of a valley of Achor and you thought, don't know that one, right? For starters, I do want to give you a pronunciation key, because I was reading it and throughout the week and I just kept saying to myself, the valley of Achor, the valley of Acorn, the valley of, I don't have this word. So here's a little key I put together for us as a church so that we remember it. It's not anchor, it's not acorn, it's Achor. All right, so you want to take our pastor, our lead pastor, and you just got to put A in front of it. And now you're never going to forget that. You're always going to remember Achor because of that photo. I had to dig deep for that photo, bro. I don't even know what's going on. That's got to be Film Fest, right? It's good. It's good. What is the Valley of Achor? There's only 3 places in the Old Testament that the Valley of Achor comes up. So it makes sense that a lot of us have never heard of it, because there are only 3 places. The first place, you have to reach back all the way into the book of Joshua. Right after the first 5 books comes Joshua, and it's a story of conquest, where God is taking his people on the promises that he gave them, and he's going to bring them into the promised land, and he's going to do so through this leader, Joshua. And on the heels of this very significant battle of Jericho, many of you have probably heard of the story of Jericho. If you haven't, there's probably some great VeggieTales you can learn some songs about. It's one of the more significant battles that takes place. Well, the Valley of Achor incident happens right after the Battle of Jericho. Right after God's people has victory over this giant city based on none of the work of their hands. It's all God's work. The walls come tumbling down without them touching it. And then the very next scene, God says to them, you can take all the things as plunder except for those things. Sounds a lot like the Garden of Eden. You can take all these things for yourself, all these things as gifts from me, except for that thing. And for those who are familiar with that Old Testament story, you can hear that echo of Eden, that re-initiation of that test, if you will, of all these things are yours except for that one. Don't touch the devoted things that are given to other gods. But lo and behold, a guy named Achan and Achor in the Hebrew are actually a play on words. Both mean trouble. Valley of Achor means trouble. Achan means troubler. And so lo and behold, the guy who was named Troubler is going to fulfill a very specific point of the story. But the Israelites, according to Joshua 7:1, the Israelites were unfaithful in regard to the devoted things that God had said, don't touch that. That's not for you. Achan, son of Carmi, the son of Zmiri, the son of Zerah, and of the tribe of Judah, took some of them. We have a thing in our small group where if ever you come across names you don't know, say them confidently and move on. So the Lord's anger burned against Israel because Achan did the thing that God said, don't do that. That's not for you, right? And in between Joshua 7:1 and 7:10, the Israelite army go up to battle a very small army, the people of Ai. Tiny in comparison to the people of Jericho that they just ruled. And they don't even send their whole army to go do it. But because of this sin, because of this thing that took place, they get beaten, bruised, and battered, and they lose the skirmish very, very quickly. And Joshua comes to God and says, why does this happen? Here's God's response. The Lord says to Joshua, stand up. What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant, which I commanded them to keep. I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy whatever among you is devoted to destruction. It's an amazing articulation or definition of sin there from God at the end of this passage. Whatever among you is devoted to destruction. Now, the catch-22 in this passage is it's actually an individual that was devoted to destruction amongst the people of Israel. And it's all his fault that the war or the battle was even lost against the people of Ai. And so Joshua heeds God's commands and says, "Why have you brought this trouble on us?" As he's talking to Achan, "The Lord will bring trouble on you today." Again, that play of words of trouble. "Then all Israel stoned him. And after they had stoned the rest, they burned them. Over Achan, they heaped in a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. Then the Lord turned from his fierce anger. Therefore, that place has been called," here it is, "the Valley of Achor," ever since. So the Valley of Achor is a place where Achan, the troubler, was put to death for his sin against God, for his devotion to destruction that ultimately led to the failure of the people group. And the judgment of one turns away the wrath and anger of God for the many. The two other places in the Old Testament that talk about the Valley of Achor are here in our passage, Hosea 2 and Isaiah 65, where we hear about Sharon, another place, will become a pasture for flocks. And again, big language of the prophets, not even sure how this is all gonna fit together yet, but the Valley of Achor is not gonna become a door of hope like it is in Hosea, but in Isaiah, it's gonna become a resting place, a place for herds, for my people who seek me. Now, the big question for the reader of the Old Testament is, why on earth is this thing coming up, this place of shame and sadness where one of our own was put to death because of his sin and leading to the death of many in the battle? This place that every time we walk by and see the stones, it creates that nasty feeling in us. Why is that the place that God is bringing up and saying, "I'm gonna do something with that"? How is God going to make that a place of hope and of rest? Before we do that, before we answer that, before we let the text answer that question, I want us to enter the story. I want us to see that we are all a people who came into this room this morning with trouble, that we all have different valleys of trouble, if you will, because you're a human being. I'm a human being. We're human beings together. In John 16, Jesus says about trouble that every single person is gonna have it. And it reads in this translation is like, you will, you're gonna be going through trouble. But a good way to interpret it is just saying, you're already experiencing it. You will have trouble, like you're having trouble on a regular basis. You're experiencing trials, temptations, sufferings, and trouble regularly as a human being. This is Oliver Berkman, who is a reporter for The Guardian, and he just wrote this incredible book. It's a complete sidetrack. It's called 4,000 Weeks. If you're a recovering productivity geek like me, this is a book about that. And yet it's the subtitle is Productivity for Mortals. I just love that. Like, stop trying to master all of your life. You're a mortal human being who's gonna die someday. Anyway, it's a great book, recommend it. This is what he says about trouble and suffering in a recent post he wrote. He says, there are two main kinds of suffering, two main kinds of trouble. There is the kind that results from power disparities between groups, things like racism, sexism, economic inequality. He goes on in the article to describe, this is something that people can do something about because it's one people group against another people group. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of headway in a lot of these categories. And he says, that's great, keep it up. Let's keep talking about that. There's also a second kind of trouble though, a second kind of suffering. Hear the words of Berkman again. Then there's this universal kind that comes with being a finite human. Faced with a limited lifespan, the inevitability of death, the unavoidability of grief and regret, the inability to control the present or predict the future, and the impossibility of ever fully knowing even those whom we're the closest. That last line hits the hardest for me. The impossibility of ever fully knowing those to whom we're even closest with in this life. It says, trouble is left and right on the outside for you as a human being. You're constantly experiencing these things that create an inner anxiety and a trouble. The author of the Proverbs says this about your heart, that the purposes of your heart are deep waters, but one who has insight draws them out. In other words, like Berkman says, you face trouble left and right on the outside, but the Proverbs helps you see, you also have trouble here on the inside. We can't even mind the intentions of our own hearts. And as I was thinking of this passage and the deep waters and the intentions and our inability to see it all, paired with this valley of trouble that we're seeing in this passage, I thought of, where's the deepest place on earth? Now, maybe somebody can correct me, but I think this is at least one of the deepest places, if not the deepest. It's the Mariana Trench, and it's 7 miles deep. And this article in Scientific American said that if you go down there, your bones will literally dissolve from all of the pressure. There's this dark, crushing depths with floor vents that reveal bubbles of liquid sulfur and carbon dioxide. The temps are just above freezing, and everything is cloaked in darkness. If you were to put Mount Everest down there on the very bottom, the peak of Mount Everest would still be 7,000 feet below sea level. Darkest place on earth. And the Proverbs is saying, this is kind of like your heart. God created these things, almost these physical things, and they have a spiritual interpretation. They have a spiritual meaning. And the darkest place on earth, the deepest waters, are kind of a picture of all of us, that we have things that we cannot see and make sense of. And so we often swim above the surface, like Marlin does in Finding Nemo, right? We're like, I don't want to go through the trench. I don't want to, even though the guy said, you got to go through the trench. I don't want to go through that. I don't want to deal with the trouble on the inside. I have enough trouble on the outside. I don't want to see the vents of liquid sulfur and carbon dioxide that are within me, that the Proverbs have diagnosed me as having. So how are we to solve this riddle of the valley of trouble, both in the Old Testament and now applying it to all of us, that we all have valleys of trouble. We all have Mariana trenches. We're all devoted to different forms of destruction, many of the times without even knowing it. Douglas Carew, an African scholar, says this about the Valley of Achor, and I love it. It's so simple. The Valley of Achor, which had previously been a place of God's wrath and his judgment on sin, will become a door of hope. Carew goes on to say, this happens ultimately on the cross of Jesus Christ, where God comes down, climbs a cross, and the wrath and the judgment on the many is redirected onto the one. And because God is the actor, God is the one who's doing it, it is becoming a door of hope that God himself is opening to us, to you, to us as a church. The place where one was punished brings healing and relief to the many. Where all the troublers, all the Achans, all the us's, all the trouble that we cause and all the trouble that we experience is poured out onto the one. And then 3 days later, he rises again from the dead to open up the door of hope so that death no longer gets the last word. Death itself is arrested, like we just sang about. This is how the New Testaments talk about Jesus Christ and his gospel, the loudest demonstration of God's grace to us, God's unmerited favor to you and to I, where judgment was once deserved. For no matter how many promises God has made in Hosea and beyond, they are yes in Jesus Christ. And so through him, the amen is spoken by us to the glory of God. God sees who we really are. He sees the deepest parts of our intentions. He sees the Mariana trenches that exist within all of us that many of us haven't even swam through yet. We're still just like Marlin swimming over them. God sees them all. And yet he does not treat us as our sins deserve. He moves towards us with the kindness of Christ, who died for you and rose again from the dead. Adam Ramsey is a church planter out in Australia, and he works with our church planting network that we're a part of here in the Midwest, where we help start new churches that proclaim this message of God's hope and grace and gospel. This message where the door of trouble is turned into a door of hope. And he runs the church planting network over there for Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. And here's what he says about this gospel of grace. Here's what he says about hearing God's words in the prophets and how you think about God. How you picture God when he speaks to you through the scriptures profoundly matters. It is the difference between thinking you're hearing from a God who wants you to change your life so that he can be around you, and a God who wants to embrace you so that your delight in him increasingly changes your life. It's the difference between the rotten stench of moralism and the fragrant aroma of the gospel. And this gospel is what the prophet Isaiah calls good news of happiness, or the prophet Hosea calls the door of hope, because it declares to us Not the works we must do to make God happy. Not our efforts to open that door. That door will always remain shut if it's our hands around the handle. But the works of a happy God on our behalf, so that his people may always be happy in him. Hear the happiness of our God in another prophet, Zephaniah, who says he's going to sing over you. The Lord your God is with you, the mighty warrior who saves. He will take great delight in you. In his love, he will no longer rebuke you, but will rejoice over you with singing. In the gospel, God rejoices over you with singing each and every day. He is a happy God of great delight, and to delight in him and to receive his word of grace and his gospel profoundly changes everything. It's why in our passage here today, the solution is not us. The solution is the work of God. When we all looked at this together on Monday morning as a staff, or six of us got together in a room, our Zoom room, because that's what we do now in 2021. Olivia Disselkamp, the director of operations, said this about this passage. Just look at God's I wills. Just hear God's I wills, because it's him doing the work for you today. In the 15 colorful, redemptive examples of how he's ultimately going to save you, just look, see, and believe. Hear the voice of your God singing over you, ultimately because of his redemptive work. God is the one who is going to bring these things to fruition. God is the one who is going to sing his own song of praises and how he's ultimately going to save and heal you and us. It reminds me of C.S. Lewis's big idea about why we all want beauty in our lives, why we all want a show like Ted Lasso to come into our living rooms during the lockdown. He says this: we don't want to merely see beauty in our daily lives. We don't want to just see it. We don't even want to just hear about it. Instead, we want something else, which we can hardly put into words. We want to be united to the beauty we see. We want to pass into it and to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become a part of it. C.S. Lewis is saying this beauty that we see and hear about is something that, as creatures made in the image of God, we are meant to enter into. Just like Christ enters into us, we are meant to enter into his song and to hear it every single day. God is constantly singing the gospel, and to see it and hear it makes all the difference. This is why when we come to the table, as we're going to do in a second here, it's broken bread and spilled blood, the wine, signifying Jesus dying and rising again for you. We enter into this gospel by receiving these elements. We bring open hands to it so that God might fill our hearts and our minds and our bellies with who he is, that we might learn to sing, that we might learn to hear. This is also why we sing back to him in these worship services, because he's worthy of praise and he is a God who is constantly singing. And so my question for us as a church is where is God inviting you to tune into the song of the gospel today? Where is God inviting you to see his ability to turn the valley of your worst troubles and the valley of your current smaller troubles into the door of hope through him, through his death and resurrection for you? So as I mentioned, I'll go ahead and invite the band up here now. We're going to be taking a communion together as a church. It kind of works like a mad circus. But what we're going to be doing here is we're going to have two lines kind of coming down the center here and funneling out. There's also some gluten-free options here down in the back and some more elements up on the top row. We'll also have our prayer team up front if you'd like to receive prayer, and maybe somebody in the back if you'd like to do so more privately. Let me ask for God's help in this moment for us to hear his song, to replace our tiredness, our burdens, and our troubles with the song of his gospel as we receive these elements and sing back to him. Jesus, you are so good to us. And the song that you have been singing since the beginning of time is something that changes lives, that you are the one who turns the worst, darkest parts of us, the things that we're even ashamed to mention. You look at that part of us and say, I see it, and I'm going to redeem it. I'm going to transform it. I'm going to take it onto my own shoulders and replace it with me, that you might have life and have it to the full. Lord, I pray that all the troubles that we have right now collectively as a church would be something that we gladly, willingly take to you in prayer and have it even replaced right now with a broken bread and spilt wine. Father, do what only you can do in this moment as we look to you and sing your praises. In Jesus' name, amen.